Okay, so it's without further ado, I'd like to introduce Al Nugent. Al did his studies at MIT, undergrad and grad work, and focused on AI, among other things. Since then, decided to perhaps move into more profitable areas, and was, among other things, was worked an engineer on one of the first HPUC systems, and is now the Vice President and CTO of Novell, and he'll be talking about open source and proprietary software, a blending of cultures. So if we could please welcome Al Nugent.
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate being here. I was reminiscing with some of my buddies this morning about the last time I did a plenary session at Usenix, and it was Portland, Oregon in, what, 85? And I still remember the first Usenix I ever attended, which was here in Boston at Copley Plaza, which was more than 25 years ago or 25 years ago or so. But it hasn't been so long that I didn't forget to spill something on my shirt because it is Usenix. So I have soiled my shirt and I'm ready to go. I want to talk a little bit about Novell, but not as a company, more as the kind of the cultural phenomena that's occurring inside Novell as we are integrating and, what I, as I like to put it, insinuating the open source community and all of the goodness therein into a culture or into a corporate DNA that was dominantly closed to proprietary source. It's both a challenge and an opportunity. It's been a lot of fun. I've been at Novell for 2 years now and had been a customer for a few years before that, so I kind of had an opportunity to see the company from both sides. A lot of the good work that Eric did when he was there, and now, you know, I'd say a complete metamorphosis within the organizations to, as they say, more readily embrace external technology in the form of open source and also adopt more readily the open source development methodology, which I think is probably the most important thing that's happened to our industry in recent years. So I want to begin, and I'll talk a little bit about myths and some other things, but I want to talk a little bit about open source as business. And, you know, there are a lot of folks out there who discuss the whether or not open source can present a viable business model, and I think that there is a tremendous amount of evidence out there today that will show rather clearly that there is business that can happen in and around open source. It isn't just about the, you know, the notion of doing things that one likes to do and having no commercial impact. I think, as I said, open source has had and will continue to have a dramatic impact on the commercial markets. And some of that will be viewed as positive and some of it will be viewed as negative. And I guess it depends upon, you know, what corner of the United States you're located in. One of the things that we talk a lot about when we talk to customers is the notion that open source does provide a significant amount of choice. And most of the large organizations that we deal with are very happy to be in a position where they can have choice. So the challenge, to balance the opportunity, is that the open source stack from an enterprise perspective is incomplete. And that's not to say that it won't ever be complete or anything like that, but as you sort of graphically depict what one might consider as a viable enterprise software stack, exclusive maybe even of applications, there are a lot of holes once you sort of get above a certain line in that vertical representation maybe of a software stack. So I'd like to start out by talking about some myths that exist, and let's put these to bed right away. So, which is the myth here? That open source will destroy the software industry or the tooth fairy? Well, it's not obviously that open source will destroy the software industry. In fact, I would argue very strongly, and hopefully you would as well, that open source has invigorated the software industry. It's presented us with a significant amount of opportunity and a significant amount of variety and diversity that did not exist primarily due to the fact that a lot of the proprietary or closed source vendors were looking to monopolize the market. And it wasn't simply, you know, Redmond, it's all across the board. If you talk to any of the large software vendors, and to an extent Novell included, the whole idea was vendor lock-in. How can we build and maintain a customer base, and how can we farm that customer base for as much as we possibly can? So again, open source is adding value and potential into the industry, not destroying it. So UFOs or open source is a haven for purple mohawked hackers who write substandard code, and argue that while there weren't purple mohawks 25 years ago, there were a significant number of hackers that made up this community, and I suspect still do. And in those days, the term hacker was not a derisive one. It was almost a badge of honor that that some of the folks in this community had worn. But having said all that, there have been a number of studies that have been published over the past few months, and as many as 66 or 70% of the people that work on open source initiatives are actually professional software developers. That is to say that their day jobs is to write code for somebody. Then they go home at night and on the weekends, presumably, although they could be sitting at their desk, I guess, doing some of this as well. They go home at night and on weekends and write software that's interesting to them or has a particular importance. So, again, despite some of the FUD that might be circulated, open source is software that's built by professionals based on their interests and the things that they know how to do best. It's definitely not a fad. Open source is here to stay. And I would argue that the numbers of initiatives are growing, the numbers of people who work within the various initiatives and as part of the community grows daily. And specifically, I give you an example, the Mono initiative, which was started by a fellow named Miguel Diaz-Caza, who was with Zimian, that and Novell acquired Zimian last year. Mono started out pretty much as a dream from Miguel and two or three or four other individuals. It grew to about 70 or 80 people and now has something like 400 or 500 working on it across the globe. And they've gone from a spark of inspiration about a year or so ago to a beta 3 and soon to be released product in about that time, a year plus, creating an entire development environment based on the ECMA standard for .NET. So it's very interesting, and you know, I would hardly say that when initiatives gain that kind of momentum and build technologies that are that important, in this particular case, bridging the gap between .NET systems and other systems, that it's hardly a fad. Open source is the right way to develop software. We believe it. We are still in the business of developing software that is not open source. There are business reasons for that, but as we begin as a company to do more and more with the community, more and more of what we embrace and provide to our customers and to the industry at large is going to be open source. It's just the nature of the way things are evolving these days. So I'll get later on into the sort of the hows and the whys and the wherefores about how we walk this fine line between developing some closed source componentry and some open source componentry. But first and foremost, we believe that open source is the right way to do things. There is money in open source for those of you who feel that capitalist streak in you. It's not always about making money, though. It is about providing a quality product to a customer, providing customer satisfaction, customer delight, however one wants to characterize it. And a large part of what we will do to make money in the business is exactly that. Package things intelligently, provide them to customers who want to buy support or maintenance so that they can feel very comfortable about putting open source into their mission critical real-time enterprises and not have to worry about who they call when something goes awry or when some legal impact may occur as a result of somebody's irrational fantasies. And, you know, Richard Stallman often talks about it's not free as in beer, but open source is free from the perspective that it's for free-thinking individuals. And yes, one can get open source technologies from the web and do whatever they like with them, and they owe nothing to anyone other than what is covered in the terms of the particular licenses. But there are many, many organizations today who take open source and turn it into something that generates revenue. And again, that's not anathema to the spirit of the community, as long as one provides a significant value-added service as a result. So how does one get successful when one starts to think about open source, especially in the context of a company that's been perhaps known as only a closed source company? And I think the three areas are listed here. One is about focus, one is about complements and substitutes, and the other is a devotion to customers or to the customer needs. When we talk about focus, we have to broaden the focus. I'm normally, as CTO, I may be sitting up here and standing up here rather and talking about technology focus and all that, but we have to think about things in a broader business context. So one needs to think about open source and how it impacts the legal frameworks that exist inside our companies, whether we are a consumer of the technology or a provider of it. So we think about alternative licensing schemes. We think about software sharing and other kinds of modalities in terms of increasing the adoption rate for open source. And in particular, in our own organization, we are in the process of working through the issues that we might have had if we tried to introduce open source technology into our customer base under our current licensing schemes. Doesn't work. You have to reconsider your business model when you begin to embrace open source, and that's something that we have done rather aggressively. And that's all part of the focus. It isn't just about a technology focus, it isn't just about integration, it's about an entire business model and a cooperative model with the community, with your customers, et cetera, in order to, again, provide the value that the customers are looking for. The other thing that's important relative to the focus is to talk about computer literacy. And again, I bring up the hacker's phrase because, as I said, for many folks, this does not carry a negative connotation. But what we really think about when we think about hackers, as we might consider some of our own people or some of the people in the community, is that they are true technology professionals. They have some of the deepest understanding of the various technologies that that we all interact with on a daily basis. And as such, we think it's important to keep those individuals focused and give them the freedom, the latitude, the environment, et cetera, to be able to do the things that they do best. And, you know, some of the most trivial examples of that might be simply the geographical diversity of an open source initiative. In the day, as I began to grow up in the computer industry too many years ago, it was all about how many people you could put into a building and have those folks work together. Today, it's about how many of the right people can you get working on the initiatives independent of where they live or what they may do above and around that particular open source initiative. So I mentioned again the Mono project, those 400 individuals that are contributing to the Mono project represent something like 86 different countries or territories. So it's unlikely that any company could muster that kind of energy and that kind of focus and that kind of literacy without the open source model. And of course, all of this has been greatly enabled by the internet. One could not think today of collaborating on any of these initiatives without this medium. And while I think it's absolutely critical for us to consider the collaborative nature of the internet, we also have to be mindful of the issues that perhaps arise as things get more and more global and more disconnected vis-a-vis wireless and other kinds of technologies. So while it's good to have a global communications capability and while it's good to have the opportunity to collaborate, we also have to be mindful of some of the issues that arise as a result of that. One of the most significant things that open source brings to the table in either its individuality of a particular initiative or collectively is it's not about one size fits all. It's about the right things. I mean, and philosophically, this goes all the way back to the work that was done early in Bell Labs. It's, you know, get rid of all the needless words. Get rid of all the needless tools. Now, you could argue that when you get a Linux distro today, there's a whole bunch of stuff on there that you might not need. But the fact that somebody might need it, and it's there, and if it's gotten from a vendor who provides it, it can be supported and maintained, that's pretty significant. So do what, you know, customers have the option, users have the option to do the things that they want to do, to individualize, to solve the problems in the ways that are most comfortable to them, as opposed to being thrust upon by some larger organization or organizational thought. So we also tend to believe that this choice forces quality. As you look at especially the larger initiatives that exist in the community today, the levels of quality are extraordinarily high, extraordinarily good. And the levels of security are extraordinarily good. It's another myth I was going to put up there, but I figured it would be beating the dead horse, about open source is insecure. It's obviously not. It's quite secure. There are those that argue that having all the eyeballs on it makes it less secure. We certainly haven't seen any evidence of that. And arguably, based on the statistics, the open source systems are considerably more secure than other systems. So if a vendor was primarily concerned with developing closed source software, why would they even consider open source? Especially if they had a business that was perhaps thriving or certainly profitable enough that they might not need to change. And I think that, you know, there certainly are business dynamics, especially if you're a public corporation, you have to have fiduciary responsibility and you are responsible to your shareholders, et cetera, to create a viable enterprise. But more importantly, you know, it's the notion of if you don't embrace change, you're going to be a victim of it. So in particular at Novell, when I arrived, part of my job, part of my challenge in the role was to ensure that open source became part of our DNA because it was a change that we believed it was going to be profound enough to affect the entire industry. So you do have to follow the money in some sense because, again, as a public corporation, we have responsibilities, but look at the stack, fill in the gaps, enable maturity in areas where perhaps there are no initiatives at this point, and generally, one will see a return as a result of that. I hearken back again to the visual or to the, you know, mental representation perhaps of an enterprise software stack. When we map it out, we actually have this line that we draw called the Linux value line. Everything below that is pretty much commoditized. Everything above that is either an open source initiative or a closed source project, because there may not be any open source initiatives there. We believe that line is going to continue to march northward. You know, we'll certainly see industrial strength, high quality J2EE app servers and more in terms of the database world, and more in terms of transactional capability and identity systems, et cetera, identity infrastructures. A lot of that is going to become more and more important and move that value line up. So again, we need to start thinking about a business model that embraces both. We have customers that have requirements that demand that they have some closed source technology, and their willingness to accept open source and the blending of the two is really the challenge that we've had to face as an organization. And again, we talk about complements and substitutes. You know, the analogy here is that French fries complement the meal, but pizza is a substitute, perhaps, for that hamburger. And when we look at the stack, we look at what we do as a technology company, what the community is doing. We think about how our technologies can complement the open source community. We try not to think about the substitution of open source components. It's the notion of why reinvent the wheel. Now, I'll give you another example of something that we're doing internally. We have a product that's essentially a VPN, sits out there, does intrusion detection, other things. We have decided to minimize our investment in the evolution of that product and are instead embracing all of the open source technologies that that product might have competed with, and are going to consolidate everything into an open source initiative to solve those problems. We'll drive that value line up by providing a internal technology that will open source and embracing all these other open source initiatives that are in that particular problem domain. Clayton Christensen from Harvard talks about the innovator's dilemma and how things, how open source, or more specifically about, sorry, more generally about disruptive technologies. And we, of course, consider open source to be a disruptive technology for our business. It's not just changing the way that we do things every day, it's changing the way we run our companies. And as far as the customers are concerned, the customers think about complementing and substituting all the time. Should I rip out product A in deference to product B? Or when the vendor comes in and tells me that I have to embrace a larger portion of their product suite that I really might want to in order to use their technology, I'm forced with a substitution decision where I really may have wanted to complement. Don't mean to stretch the analogy, but it works pretty well. It's not very different than build by partner. And we also think that as more and more larger organizations begin to embrace open source, it will increase the potential for reasonable vendor interaction. The one thing that is scary to a lot of the hardware vendors in particular is the potential balkanization of Linux, as Unix was balkanized a bit during the 80s. They don't want every vendor to have a version of Linux. They'd like there to be only a couple of enterprise Linuxes in the market. I mean, in terms of the other versions, it's fair game. But when you talk to the IHVs of the world, they want to minimize their investments in testing and quality assurance and platform support and that sort of stuff. So if you think about open source versus closed source, in the closed source model, the classical control points are listed here: trade secrets, patents, private expressions of intellectual property and source code, copyrights, and control, especially around the architecture. But you look at sort of the comparative, if you will, in the open source world, well, there still are copyrights, but things are viewed very, very differently. Instead of rigorous and, in some cases, overbearing structures, you have the maintainers, innovators, the committers, etc. The notion of distribution and the notion of support is most important. So, again, as a company that's coming from left to right, we don't ever expect to be completely on the right or completely on the left anymore. Our product portfolio moving forward will embrace all of this diversity, and we'll deal with the conflict as it comes up. right now we have to be very careful as we develop software that leverages the Linux distributions, because we don't want to contaminate either the Linux distribution or the code that we wish to remain closed source for whatever period of time. So it is a bit of a balancing act, and these were some slides that I took from the initial presentations that we did internally, just to give you a sense of where our thinking was relative to all this. We also looked at kind of a benefit analysis, not a cost benefit analysis though, but a customer benefit analysis and a vendor benefit analysis, and tried to map and do some gap analysis on these. Customer benefits around choice. I'm not going to read the slides to you, but around interoperability, cost, and security, and the vendor benefits about leverage and ubiquity, having a greater ecosystem, et cetera, and the notion of riding the open source torrent. I like to use a concrete example, the Mono project again. When we brought the Mono project into Novell through the Zimian acquisition, as I said, there were only a very small number of engineers working on it. We decided to hire 22 engineers and put them on our payroll to work on Mono, a complete open source initiative, not anything that we are going to make money off of. And those individuals worked and continue to work on Mono, and everything that they do is contributed back to the community. So one might ask, well, why would a closed source vendor or a mixed source vendor like Novell want to do that, want to incur the cost of 20 engineers, 20 plus engineers, to do this? And the answer is leverage. It gives us an opportunity to now consolidate the work of 400 individuals. And it provides a service back to the community. It gives the community a product that, in fact, is being used by a number of commercial software developers now to produce code that runs both on a .NET platform and on a Linux platform. So I'd take those ratios any day of the week if I can get 400 resources for an investment of 20. And the community benefits, sign me up. So when you come right down to it, what does it mean to be a mixed source company? Well, you need to be cognizant of your responsibilities as a trustee. You need to coexist. And in our particular case, we needed to align our ecosystem with this new or relatively new thing. As part of these slides were used in our internal analysis. As part of our analysis, we determined that we needed to own a distribution in order to be able to, again, satisfy the needs of the emerging enterprise market, a market we were pretty familiar with. And we also wanted to own the distribution because we wanted to be able to contribute at that level across the entire distro. And we're now able to do that very, very easily because of the way that we have integrated the SUSE development and the Zimian development communities with our own internally. We want some of our folks, regardless of where they came from in terms of traditional Novell or Zimian or Silverstream or whomever, we want them to grow and be respected by the community and become maintainers. There are a few, but we certainly would like to have more. And as the community's respect for the work that we do grows, I presume we will have more and more maintainers as part of our organization. At some point, we think that just about every product that we produce will have some relevance to open source. And may, in future years, we may entirely be open source. I don't know that, and I'm not here to say that that is the case, but just by virtue of that line of in the slide there, it's pretty clear that we are willing to go in that direction if that's what the community and the markets, if that's where the community and markets will take us. And we're also very careful about our next generation product development technology such that it doesn't push aside or subsume unfairly any open source initiative. So, you know, we will continue to develop a proprietary solution around our identity provisioning tools because there really isn't anybody in the community working on that. It's maybe not interesting to them, or there's not a problem they wish to solve, but that's just sort of one example. We're going to, I think, be a leader in the industry relative to how a company coexists. Certainly IBM is doing a good job with this. Hewlett-Packard's doing a good job with this. Oracle's doing a good job with this. You know, having closed source technology and open source technology side by side. As a company, we are more and more engaged in standards organizations, more than ever in the past. And unlike, I'd say, the Novell of 5 or 6 years ago, where we might have attended standards organizations, here we're actually adhering to the standards and helping to set them and adopting them, with the plan being that it will make us a more interoperable organization. And these are some of the areas where we think we have some significant technology that we will use in and around the open source, and that's around storage and grids, resource management, I mentioned identity a few minutes ago, web services, et cetera. And then we need to think about our ecosystem, and we've got thousands of industry partners out there. We've got a pretty rich collection of learning and development capabilities, support, et cetera. All those things need to be brought to bear on helping customers as they begin their journey towards integrating closed and open source technologies. And I think that probably the most obvious change for us inside the company is that that last bullet is building sustainable partnerships with business or enterprise class applications. For the longest time, our traditional platform was unappealing to independent software vendors because of the difficulty of putting applications on it. Well, that's kind of moot when you come to the Linux platform because it's the platform that most ISVs want to be on. So for us, this is a bit of a challenge, but it's something that we're, I think, doing a very good job at. So I guess the theme is coexist. There are companies out there on both sides of the fence who would lead you to believe that everything should be all one or the other. I think that's impractical. The diversity of our business and the things that we've done over the past few decades has demonstrated that it isn't just about one thing. It's about how we take things and make them, assemble them, and craft them in ways that solve problems, whether it's for ourselves or for our customers or for our companies or whatever. So we don't think that there's any conflict between IP and open source, legal issues notwithstanding. And I was told to end a little early in case there were questions, so that's the end of the presentation. If there are questions, I'd be happy to take them. And I do thank you for the time and the opportunity to speak and be with you here this morning. So it's been a long time since I've been at a Usenix, and it's nice to be back.
Hi, Peter Honeyman, University of Michigan. You said that in areas where you have a proprietary advantage, like in the identity management, you're not really interested in open source. So does this mean that Novell doesn't really have a philosophical bias in favor of open source? It's just a money-making scheme for them?
I missed part of that question. I'm sorry. I heard philosophical bias and money-making.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That sounded kind of juxtaposed to me.
Yeah, I didn't say whore, ever.
I was sitting down, so I can't possibly be able.
You said that in areas where Novell has a proprietary advantage, like the identity management, you're not interested in opening up your source and using that as, you know, sort of a staging for development by the open source community, but you want to keep that private because it's a money-making enterprise for you. Is that is that the extent of your commitment to open source?
No.
That you'll rely on open source in areas where you can make money with it, and then in other areas where you can make money without it, you won't use it.
No, perhaps I misspoke. Let me see if I can clarify. one of the reasons why we would not put a particular closed source piece of technology into open source is because there isn't a community around it, or the indications that we've gotten is that there isn't an interest around it.
This is self-fulfilling, right?
I suppose on one could think about it that way, but we could open, and let me step back. The other thing that the open source community is very resistant about is putting technology out there that is either A, old, or B, crufty. And it would be an embarrassment for any organization to put code out there that was ugly. And, you know, there may be self-serving in that sense, in that there's a level of embarrassment. I'm not saying necessarily for us, but for any vendor who has been developing technology for a long time and may not be, you know, really proud of the way that it looks. And if we were to take an existing piece of technology and put it out there and then, you know, start working on the evolution of that product, there would be issues relative to how that is managed within the community. You don't want to put old stuff out there either. So one could argue that you can look at it either way, that we're being self-serving or we're being intellectually honest with the community. If we've got technologies that the community is just not interested in working on, then what's the point? I mean, why, if we could put it out there, but if nobody's going to work on it but us anyway. And by the way, I would also take exception to the fact that if we put it into open source, we wouldn't make money on it. We absolutely would. That's the whole point, is that whatever you put into open source still needs to be maintained and supported. And that our customers pay us for that. They don't pay us to hand them a CD. So it's a different model, and we're embracing that model. It's not about the licensing fees anymore. It's about keeping the enterprises running.
Thank you.
David Lynn, Vanderbilt University. If I understand you correctly, Novell is going to move to a hybrid system where you have a lot of open source software with some proprietary software as a value add. We have recently purchased a sizable package from another vendor. I open up the tarball, and 90% of it's open source with 10% of their stuff. So this is the same sort of model. Almost everything in the tarball was out of date except for their software. What is a company like Novell going to do? Because you said it's about servicing and supporting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you service and support your software when it's written to bugs in older versions of open source packages?
Well, let's see, there's a bunch of ways to answer this. Okay, we really have two major thrusts inside the organization now, but there will be three starting in the fall. There's what we call the box product, which, of course, is just the SUSE box product that you all may be familiar with. SUSE 9.1 now, both personal and professional. It's, you know, on Amazon and in CompUSA and other places. Then we have two sort of enterprise class distros. In either case, whether it's the box version or the enterprise distro for the server or the desktop being the third product that we'll introduce in the fall, you get a subscription service with that. It's maintained by Red Carpet, which is the patch and update delivery capability. All of the changes that we're now starting to put the distro and all the changes up on FTP and mirror sites all over. And SUSE itself has a maintenance site. If you don't want to get maintenance on the Novell product you buy SUSE 9.1, you can just say connect up to their FTP server and download security patches or updates or whatever. So the bottom line is, if it's in the distro, if it's part of the distro, if it comes on those DVDs or you download the ISOs, you burn them, it will be supported and changes will be reflected. The consumption of those patches and changes are based on your own particular organization's policies. I mean, you can let them happen as they happen, or you can aggregate them. A lot of our customers are putting a Red Carpet service up inside the firewall. They bring the changes in, and then they have policy that goes out and extracts the especially the security pieces if they should come about, but any other changes as necessary based on the inventory of the system. So it goes out and it says, oh, there's a new version of Apache. I better download it and install it. So if it's in the distro, we support it. It's that simple. We don't care where it came from. And in the case of some of our software that lays above the distribution, we have this product called the Novell Enterprise Linux Services. It runs on both SUSE and Red Hat. We not only support the Novell Linux Services, we also support the distros, whether it's SUSE or Red Hat. So we don't do this when the phone rings. If it's a problem with even the Red Hat distribution, we'll go in and figure it out, and we'll get that customer going again. So, and it follows the same model. If you're a customer and you've got a support contract, you have access to every single changed component, whatever they may happen to be, for whatever reason, and you consume them at your leisure.
Thank you.
Sure. I don't know. It's up to you guys.
Greg Mitchell. So I'm curious about the sociology inside the company of moving a bunch of developers from very proprietary development to a more open source. I noticed, with some happiness that if I read the attendee list right, there are twice as many Novell people at Usenix today than there are Microsoft people. Unfortunately, there's only one Microsoft person, so the numbers aren't, in absolute sense, not particularly high. But I'm sort of wondering if the way of doing it is to sort of, is through acquisition where you acquire more open source developers, and how much, how resistant to change is the development community inside the organization?
There's a couple of answers to that, and it gets down to the kind of the cultural implications, as I mentioned earlier. The infusion of the open source teams as they've come through the acquisitions has been a blessing. There's more energy inside the company than there had been, not simply because of youthful exuberance, but simply because here are a bunch of talented engineers who are coming in and revitalizing in just about every dimension the things that we do as a company. So that's sort of the, and by the way, as a result of the acquisitions, we haven't lost a person. And that's unusual. Novell was never really very well liked in the 90s because of their acquisition strategy, which kind of shot most of the management and the domain talent and subsumed them into an organization never to be heard from again. We've gotten considerably better. In fact, the president and CEO of Zimian runs our resource management business unit, which includes Novell and Zimian products, traditional Novell. David Litwack, who is the CEO of Silverstream, runs our secure identity services organization, running people doing traditional and web service-based stuff. And Richard Seat, who used to be the CEO for SUSE, runs our entire European operation. So, in contrast to the way we behaved in the past, we've not only embraced the talent, but we've embraced the organization. The team who's working on iFolder, our next-generation file sharing capability, is 90% Novell, traditional Novell employees. They're doing extreme programming, they're using Mono, daily builds, and they've cranked out a client that the executable runs on Windows as a .exe and runs under Mono, the same .exe, on a Linux system. So, I mean, these guys have bought in big time. And that's a microcosm, but it's a very important one, because that we're seeing throughout the entire engineering organization. Were there people who were upset? Absolutely. Did some Novell people leave as a result of the decision? Absolutely. I mean, you know, we can't please everyone all the time, but I am very, very pleased at the intermixing that's been going on culturally, and the fact that the antibodies haven't gotten together to reject the transplanted organs.
Good morning. Dave Gold with Cambridge Computer. I would think that small and medium-sized businesses who are a little more price-sensitive and don't always look at the support issues would open up some competition against, in your case, Novell, for what's essentially an open-source product that other companies could basically go in there, put their own distribution together, and sell. How have you dealt with concerns about competition, price wars, and other things? For a lot of what you've talked about is adding value through support as a primary thing, and that makes a lot of sense for enterprise customers. But what about the smaller and medium-sized ones?
A good question. Yeah, I didn't really get into sort of, you know, market segmentation, because God knows I'm probably the last guy that should talk about marketing. But well, maybe not. anyway, the small and medium business, in terms of the way we operate as a company, is managed through our partner community. And the partner community is ultimately responsible for selling or not selling, as the case may be, a support contract, which they can enforce or we can enforce on their behalf. It turns out that the partner community is, again, incredibly invigorated as a result of the work that we've been doing and the direction that we've taken, because now they can take the plain vanilla distro, they can provide it in the same way that other companies may pull together something and provide it, and they can provide the support themselves, or they can, you know, contract with us to provide support, or they can provide no support at all and sell some other services that they might have. But so we're, when, you know, a lot of the talk here is about how we're working together inside the company to deliver to the market, and maybe a little unfairly, I biased it towards the larger enterprise customer and the thought process behind that as opposed to SMB. But that's primarily, again, because of our business model, where SMB is handled by the partner channel, or the channel partners, rather. So I think it's a vital and important business, and, you know, we're doing quite a bit with our channel. We've provided hundreds and hundreds of hours, thousands of hours of free training to the partner community on Linux products, on the community, et cetera. Our partners are taking our certified Linux engineer courses and re-delivering them. We don't charge them for the ability to do that, because, again, it just builds more competence and hopefully increases the adoption. So I don't see that there are any more questions, and you guys probably need a coffee break. So, again, thank you so much for coming, and enjoy the conference. Thank you.